Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, if you had to say what was the most important battle that ever took place in the whole history of the world, down here we would probably jump to say Gettysburg, or maybe remember in World War II, Normandy. And then, I don't know, but you can't decide. Well, there's help. It's a new book, Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. One of the co-authors, Jim Lacy. Jim, I hope I can call you. Can I call you Jim instead of James, or would you prefer?
Jim is fine.
Is that or Dr. No, Lacy, Mr. Lacy, Lieutenant Colonel Lacy?
Jim is preferred.
Jim Lacy is the co-author of this book, and he and his co-author, Williamson Murray, have chosen 20 important military engagements that shaped the world or changed the world. And Jim, thanks for visiting with us down in Chapel Hill. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
You want to talk a little? I don't know whether to. I'm always interested in how a book got constructed. But let's talk about the subject of the book. And you picked out 20 battles.
Right.
What you've heard us down in North Carolina in the South. It's always Gettysburg. That's what changed the world for us. What battle, after all of the 20 that you selected, what battle do you like to talk about the most?
Oh, I don't know that, you know, even in my crowd, they very rarely come up in party conversation. But, you know, we decided, you know, between me and Wick, we went over a long list of battles and tried to pick the 20 that the world is still feeling the effects of today. That doesn't mean it's the most important battle militarily or the biggest battle or the largest battle. And there was some serious debate on a number of these between me and him. And, you know, we even alerted the publisher. And when this book comes out, you know, you're going to see a lot of reviews on Amazon, and they're going to take a star away from us or two stars away from us because we didn't put their favorite battle.
You didn't put their, yeah, of course. Well, I think you've got all of my favorites, but let's talk about some of the ones that I had not focused on before.
Right.
And maybe that would be, I tell you what, there's a great interest, I think, in early history at least, about the role of the Greeks in history, about the role of Alexander the Great and to what extent he was or was not a great, and then this sort of puzzlement about how he was able to conquer the world. And you've picked out a battle, I have to say, that I'd never heard of. I mean, this is just awful, but, and I'm not sure I can say it. Guacamole?
Gorgimela.
Gorgimela.
I've heard it pronounced 100 different ways myself. Used to be every history book called it Arabella.
Aha.
So now
I still missed it. It's not only an interesting battle militarily, but it's that you're discussion of its importance is also one which is convincing. And so will you share that with us?
Well, it was Alexander the Great's largest, most important battle. It decided the issue between the Greeks and the Persian Empire. After Arabella, the Persian Empire was never able to resurrect a military force that could stand against Alexander. And he just went from city to city, conquering the entire region. And one of the questions you said there is, you know, is Alexander a great general? Me and Wick are actually starting to put together a book now on when great generals fight each other, Napoleon, Wellington, Grant, Lee, things along that line. And, you know, Alexander doesn't make the list.
He doesn't make the list. I thought you were going to say, well, he and Darius were both great generals.
We don't know. We don't even know. We can't even be sure Alexander was a great general. Maybe Darius was so incompetent. He just got off lucky that, you know, Jim Lacy could have beaten him time after time. You know, Alexander the Great beat Darius in three major engagements, and those are the three engagements he's famous for. I'm being a bit facetious there. We don't want to take any away from Alexander the Great. You know, he did conquer most of the known world by the time he was 32.
Tell us about the lead up to this battle and the conflict between the Greeks and the Persians, or the Westerners and the Easterners.
Well, the Greek and Persian conflict started considerably before that. You know, the Ionian cities on the east coast of the Aegean were conquered by the Persians, and those were all Greek cities with ties to Athens. They revolted. Athens tried to help them in a minimal way, and that led to the first Persian invasion of Greece, which ended with the Battle of Marathon, which is the first chapter of the book, mm-hmm. and probably, I would say, the most important battle in history, at least Western history. You know, if the Greeks had lost that battle, Greek civilization, as we know it, and everything that contributed to the Roman civilization, would have been snuffed out immediately. The whole idea of democracy, free markets, everything we now count as part of Western civilization would have died under the Persian Empire. But the Greeks did win the Battle of Marathon. Then 10 years later, they had the confidence, because of what they did at Marathon, to fight the Persians again at Thermopylae, Salamis. Now, Thermopylae, famous to most people now from the movie 300. Salamis, and then Plataea. And that pushed the Persian Empire. It made sure the Persians never attacked Greece again in any major way. Now, Greece attempted to commit suicide through the Peloponnesian War when the Spartans and the Athenians turned on each other. And then Thebes turning on Sparta. And it's a long, complicated story. But eventually, Greece was so weakened that Alexander the Great's father, Philip, was able to march into Greece and conquer the entire place. And by this time, I wouldn't say the Persian Empire was particularly weak. It just had no way to fight the army Alexander the Great put together to fight, to come at it. You know, the Persians were very, you know, it was an empire built by force and held together by force. But they were used to fighting on the plains of Anatolia and fighting the Scythians, and they never came up with a way to defeat heavy Greek infantry on a field of battle.
What do you mean by heavy Greek infantry?
The Greek hoplites, armored almost head to toe, you know, shields, breastplates, greaves on it, protecting their legs, haplon shields, which covered a large portion of their body, strong, high discipline so that those, you know, those shields would interlock and form a solid wall that came right at you. And the only Persian infantry, once they got through the arrows, which they did relatively quickly since they were so heavily armored, they usually got through virtually unscathed. The Battle of Plataea, the Spartans were famous for just sitting there, literally sitting there under their shields during an arrow storm, while behind the lines the priests were sacrificing animals one after another, waiting to see if they could get a good omen to attack. And the infantry that protected those archers, all they had was wicker shields. When wicker meets steel, the conclusion is pretty much foregone. So when at the Battle of Gaugamela, when Alexander the Great's phalanx, the massed Greek infantry, finally hit into the Persian line, it was just grinding their way through. And when a gap formed, it left enough room for Alexander and his elite force. They called them the Companion Cavalry. I pronounced that word wrong a lot. Somebody at the one radio show actually had 20 listeners write in to tell me how to pronounce it.
You're not going to get any quarrel from me right now. Maybe some of the listeners will quarrel with us about the pronunciation. But
smashed into the gap and broke a Persian army probably at least five times his size.
Well, the one of the things that I think your book helped me understand, although it wasn't a specific point, was that after this battle, after Darius was defeated, then there is an answer to the question about how Alexander was able to conquer so much more so quickly. And I mean, my answer is that without the Persian army and without the Darius and his it just kind of fell apart. So there was nothing really, no big organized opposition to Alexander. There was a lot of local opposition, but he was able to march without being confronting anybody nearly as strong as he was. And so after this battle, he kind of went all the way to India.
Right, and he didn't meet another army until he got to India. From that point on, Alexander's greatest enemy was himself. His army. The army said, "Well, that's it. We're not going any further. We've conquered enough." And Alexander tried to march him across the desert to come home, and lost probably 2/3 or more of his army was lost to the desert. You know, he had to replace that. He did fight long guerrilla campaigns in a place that's well known to us today in Afghanistan. I actually spent some time there last year, a year and a half ago. It was amazing to be in Kandahar and realize that Kandahar means Alexander's city. That Alexander the Great built that as a fortified camp when he was trying to pacify the Afghan rebels 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years ago.
Takes a while to learn a lesson, maybe.
I think he was the last one to conquer and pacify the region. After his death, it didn't stay pacified for long.
We're visiting with Jim Lacy. He's a co-author of Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jim Lacy. Jim is the co-author of Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. We can't talk about all 20. I'm trying to get Jim to talk about some that he thinks are most important or most interesting. I mean, he's cooperating a little bit, but I'm having them to say the ones that let's talk about the ones that I didn't know about. And another one that I think is important with respect to the world as we know it, which I hadn't focused on before, is the Teutoburger Wald, I guess, which is where the Romans met their match with the Germanic tribes. And again, Jim, I picked this out because this is not a battle that I focused on. Tell us about it and tell us why it was important.
Well, why it was important is it's where the Roman Empire was finally stopped. Could they have gone further? Maybe. They could have been more persistent in trying to conquer Germany, but in the final analysis, it wasn't worth the time and effort to conquer lands that weren't going to produce anything economically for a century or more. But they did make a first initial effort, and they thought they had won until three of their legions were trapped by German barbarians in a major revolt and literally annihilated. And it's famous. Those who have heard of it, you know, if they read any books about Augustus or know that the early Roman Empire, that Augustus walked around for weeks afterwards, you know, growing his hair long, refusing to shave, yelling, "Varsus, Varsus, give me back my legions." Varsus was a Roman commander at the time. It was a major shock to the Roman system. They hadn't suffered a defeat like this since in probably 100 years or close to it, Carre, when the name just went out of my head, I'm sorry. The Parthians trapped and almost annihilated several Roman legions. As part of the triumvirate with Caesar, Pompey, Crassus was the commander, I'm sorry. But what this did was create the Latin-German divide. If the Romans had won the Teutoburg Wall and pacified Germany, the Teutonic region would have been part of the Roman Empire. There wouldn't have been this Romance languages in France, Spain, and Italy, and then this Germanic language on the other side of the Rhine River. All of that would have been Roman. It would have brought Germany into the Roman cultural sphere. And what that would have done to future history is almost incalculable. Instead of a border on the Rhine, which caused all sorts of problems for, you know, just look at the 20th century, the German-Latin divide there in the World War I and World War II. This is a very good chance if Teutoburg Wall didn't happen, those wars didn't happen, because the entire course of German history would have been altered at that spot. But the battle did happen. Rome lost three legions, and the Roman Empire drew its line on Danube and on the Rhine River from that point forward. But they did make numerous excursions into Germany. They never again went in to try and conquer the place. So
they learned a lesson, I guess, maybe similar to the one we alluded to earlier about Afghanistan, and that is at some point you see you can't control, so you back away and build a wall between you and the people you can't control.
Right.
And
well,
that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't.
Well, Rome never built a... You know, they did build a wall. I shouldn't call it that. There's a lot of dispute about what the Roman frontier actually was. They called it the Limes, or historians call it the Limes now. Rome, that wall was incredibly porous. When Rome saw danger forming on the other side of the Rhine River or the Danube River, the legions marched in. What they did not do was stay. They went in. They did as much damage to whoever was threatening them as possible, and then they returned home. And they did this relatively successfully for at least 250 years before the Goths, the crisis of the third century, as they call it. If you, you know, if the lesson I would draw from, if you, you could build your walls, but walls are permeable. The bad guys can get across walls. You have to stay involved on the outside. But there are limits to empire. No, not, even the greatest empires of the world aren't omnipotent.
They can't do everything. Yeah. Well, there's a great side story to this this battle, as you guys describe it, about a German, a native German who gained Roman citizenship and trust, and he gained a military education thanks to the Romans, and they trusted him.
Right.
And then he became the leader of the revolt.
Right.
And can you tell us that story? I mean, what?
Well, Hermann, and the Germans call him Arminius, as the Romans called him. His family, his tribe, was considered friends of the Roman people and Senate. They've been declared such. He actually was trained in Rome, brought up in Rome, educated in Rome, commanded troops, auxiliaries for Rome. And Rome thought he was on their side. Thought, you know, this is a guy we could, this is a guy in their camp that's on our side. His father and his brother, during the entire crisis after Teutoburg Wald, remained loyal to Rome. And in fact, they actually tried to warn the Romans and say, "Hey, you can't trust this guy." But the Varsus did trust him, and he led him into a trap. You know, Rome had a pretty good track record of co-opting the locals, but it wasn't a perfect track record. And this is one that Rome got wrong and paid an incredibly heavy price for it. Rome had a long memory and never forgot. The legions didn't just abandon Germany. They came back several years later and laid waste to large areas of Germany in punishment for Teutoburg Wald. Can never forget, you know, Rome was still powerful. Rome cannot let an insult like losing three legions go by unremarked or unrevenged. The main point is they realized they couldn't conquer Germany from this point on.
What happened to Hermann or Arminius, the German?
He was killed by another German in a local tribal fight.
So yeah.
When they weren't fighting the Romans, the German tribes spent most of their time fighting each other. Arminius probably overstayed his hand. You know, I don't think the history of that period is very good. I would not be surprised to find out the Romans paid someone to get him. But the Romans made a habit of tracing and tracking their enemies until death. When you, how do I say this shortly? If you declared war on Rome, you were making a serious commitment about your future.
It was interesting. It's sort of the put these thoughts about Roman war making theory in the modern times. Sort of what we call the Powell Doctrine that we've abandoned, I guess, in the United States, but it is, if you are going to apply military force, you apply it overwhelmingly quickly with a defined result. You achieve that result, and then you finish up and get out. And this seemed to be, at least along the German frontier, the way the Romans, I guess all over, the Romans said, if you force us to make a military response, we're going to crush you. And that's all there is to it. You can know that,
right.
And it's not we're going to come in and maybe pester you a little bit, or we're going to come in and just punish you a little bit, or we're going to send our troops in, or we're going to put a blockade on you, or something like that. They went in with overwhelming force. Is that a good lesson to learn, or is that something we better watch out?
In a perfect world, you know, I like to extrapolate history into the present and the future, but things are imperfect. I mean, as the Roman proverb goes, or as the saying goes, we Romans create a desert and call it peace.
I like that quote.
A portion of a Seneca comment, I believe, is someone talking to a Roman and saying, you know, the whole world hates you, and the Romans let them hate so long as they fear. I'm not sure you could transfer the Roman method of, you know, and create a Carthaginian peace wherever we go anymore. American power is, America is probably the most restrained superpower in all of history. I actually wrote a column about this 2 weeks ago, last week, actually. There's lessons to be learned about punishing enemies. Things, you know, even Rome didn't always send overwhelming force. You know, they sent what they could afford to send. They used the entire diplomatic kit bag. You know, we could say Rome is successful. It had a grand strategy that held the line for 400 years, you know, 400 plus years. But those legions were constantly at war. It wasn't like, you know, there's ever a time during those 400 years that Roman legions weren't fighting someplace. Well, so, you know, if we're willing to have our military at war for a century, then the Roman method is might be the way to go. But I don't think anyone in the United States is willing to, one, fight as brutally as the Romans did. I mean, that's a period, what they did in that period of history doesn't translate well into this period of history. And I think we want to do a lot of other things in terms of shaping the global environment and helping our allies and maintaining a peace that keeps our military in a position where it's powerful and can strike whenever it is forced to strike, but it's got to move into second or third position. It can't be the first resort on many things.
Well, we're visiting, Jim, we're visiting with Jim Lacy. He's the co-author of Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. He and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jim Lacy. He and his co-author, Williamson Murray, have written a book called Moment of Battle. It's about the 20 clashes that changed the world. We can't talk about all of them. I'm trying to get Jim Lacy to talk about some of these battles that I'm either unfamiliar with or less familiar with than some of the others. Some of the obvious ones, of course, are Gettysburg and Normandy. Vicksburg, Midway, the Battle of Britain. We wouldn't argue with you. You will learn in the book a lot more than you know. Jim, continuing along the lines of battles that I'm not familiar with, is the Battle of Breitenfeld, the creation of modern war. And this is, I just don't know about this, but you say that they were, the way of organizing and an army that is critical from this battle. But why did you choose this battle?
Actually, this is one of the battles me and my co-writer fought about the most.
Why?
Well, he wanted to do it.
You can just say, tell us why did he think it was so important?
Well, the 30 Years' War was a one of the most brutal wars in history. I mean, that left between 30 and 50% of the German population dead at the end of it from all sorts of things. But for military purposes, it did remake war. Gustavus Adolphus brought the first modern staffs to war.
He brought the first modern staffs?
Operations, a rudimentary staff that later became, you know, the models that they built upon that for the Prussian general staff and our staffs. Prior to this, it was the king and his local retainers, basically, you know.
He just gave them different, as he gave his leaders or his lieutenants specific
responsibilities. The staff system we have today can be traced directly back to Gustavus Adolphus's Swedish army. That is a major, major development in military terms. You know, the integration of cavalry, mobile artillery artillery had been on certain battlefields, but he was the first one to make it truly a mobile arm that could actually have a decisive influence on the battlefield. Professional army paid for by the states, maintained over a long period of time. It's the beginning of the change that moves you from the medieval to the modern era. More importantly, Breitenfeld decided that Protestantism would continue to exist. Had the Catholic, the Imperial Army won at Breitenfeld, they probably would have swept through Germany, killing all of the princes that were Protestant and bringing those areas back into the Catholic fold. Could Protestantism have hung on? Maybe, but it probably would have been more of a fringe element on the Christian faith than the dominant element it has become today. So it did have a long-lasting impact, as did several of the other battles during that war.
Who was fighting whom in this battle?
That's a good question. It started off as, the imperial forces,
Well, if Augustus Adolphus, I guess the Swedes were at least involved in some.
Well, they came in late when it looked like the imperial forces and the Catholic side was going to win. Then the Swedes came in. Later, the French, though they were Catholic, came in on the side of the Protestants because they were thinking in pure power play. The Spanish got to explain the 30 years war in the time we have is almost impossible. there has been a couple of great books on it in the recent time, but you really have to love the period and you really have to love the war even to
In the battle itself,
right
on the Protestant side, you've got the Swedish army under the command of the king, I guess.
Under the command of the king himself, correctly. Correct.
And then who's challenging them?
Now, the imperial armies were commanded by Tilly, Wallenstein. Wallenstein was there, but these are contract armies. Wallenstein, the most successful general up until Gustavus Adolphus there, would literally build, contracts with different captains, they called them. Who would bring 150 men or 200 men or 300 men. He would be paid by Wallenstein. Wallenstein would bill back to the imperial throne for whatever the cost was, plus a hefty profit to himself. And then they would take whatever they could by hook and by crook, thievery. I mean, it was a brutal war. They just decimated areas when they moved in. There's been a couple of great books recently, if anyone's interested. There's a 30 Years' War by Peter Wilson. And there's a book, and I'm trying to think of the name of it, that just goes over how brutal it was. It doesn't really give you a concise history, but it tells you about the age and the period. And it just recently came out.
We'll get back to that. This is in the 1600s already, and one of the things that your book brings out in some of these earlier battles that we didn't talk about is the brutality with which the war was fought and the way in which even the civilian victims were treated. And if you, for instance, Alexander, as you describe him when he's conquering some of these cities that had been a part of the Persian Empire and resisted Alexander, that if they didn't surrender immediately, when they were captured, he'd just kill all the men and sell the women and children into slavery. I mean,
that was the rules.
Yeah.
Everyone understood that. If a city had to be taken by storm, then it was given over to sack. Even if the siege went on too long, it could be given over to sack. It was up to the city and the commander of the city to make the best deal they could when an army approached. How long could it hold out? Was help on the way? If we hold out for 30 days, what will they do to us? There's a lot of negotiations going back and forth. But, all through history until the advent of the modern era, the rules of the game were different. And even today, you see, let's look at the Congo. I mean, when a force goes in and wins a battle, they immediately start raping the women and stealing everything possible. I mean, war is savagery no matter what, but you don't start, you know, no one started concerning themselves about the local population until, you know, the modern era, the beginning of when the ideas of just war, just peace started moving out of just the religious realm and into the realm of legal terms, legalistic concerns became important. As countries had to form armies that were professional and keep them in pay for years, decades, or longer, you were able to instill some sort of discipline.
We're visiting with Jim Lacy, who is the co-author of Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Jim Lacy, who is a co-author of a new book. In fact, it's just coming out just really as we speak, officially. It's called Moment of Battle, The 20 Clashes That Changed the World. And Jim, I've made you talk about some of the battles that are maybe not at the top of everyone's list in terms of familiarity, that you guys make a persuasive case that we should be paying more attention to them and give the reasons. But I haven't given you the opportunity to say what battle you think is the most important. And maybe to restrict it, you'd say, what about World War II, where we had a lot of battles that were very important? What was the most important battle in World War II, according to you guys?
Okay. Well, this is always a troublesome area. One, because a whole bunch of people's reading this book will have a lot more familiarity with World War II battles than they have with, you know, ancient, medieval, and even early modern era. And they all have their favorites. You know, there's a lot of, why isn't Stalingrad on there? Why did you pick Kursk instead? You know, and from our viewpoint, Stalingrad decided the Germans weren't going to win the war, but Kursk decided that they were going to lose it. They didn't have to attack at Kursk. They could have husbanded all those armored forces and held the Russians at stalemate until they could have negotiated a peace. Even if the Allies came in behind them, we would have gotten Eastern Europe instead of the Russians. So we said that one, Stalingrad's definitely a decisive battle, but the one that had the biggest impact on our current day was probably Kursk.
Well, tell us a little bit about Kursk, because we do hear about Stalingrad a whole lot more than we hear about Kursk.
Well, the history of Kursk is changing all of the time as new evidence comes out. And Denny Showalter's got a book comes out this summer on it. And forget his first name, Dr. Satano, he's at North Texas, writes about this period and writes about the Battle of Kursk a lot. The German army wasn't beaten as badly as we assumed, but it was beaten pretty badly. And it was the largest tank battle in history, at least that's how it was billed at the time and for many decades afterwards. A swirling battle of thousands of tanks that was, you know, at the time, when it was over, they called it the death ride of the 4th Panzer Army. The German forces from that point on were never able to launch a major attack on Russia again. They were continually on the defensive.
This was their last big offensive on the Eastern Front. Is this the...
It was their last great offensive. They had a lot of local attacks, but nothing that matched what the Russians have been fighting off since the invasion and then the second invasion in 42, things along that line.
Is it Charles' theory that this was that if the Germans had resisted the temptation to fight at Kursk, they could have held their forces together and maintained a defensive stable frontier with the Soviets not being able to drive them back? Is that sort of the deal?
Nothing's known for sure, but they could have had, if they hadn't squandered their precious armored forces, they would have had the ability to create a defense in depth of highly mobile forces. I mean, even after Kursk, they held on for 2 years. You know, if they could have had a rational strategy that pulled back to shorten lines behind rivers and use that armor as a mobile reserve wherever the Russians broke through instead of squandering it in their own attacks that had to fight their way through 5 defensive belts. I mean, it was horrendous, the Battle of Kursk. Horrendous scale, horrendous losses. I honestly believe it would have turned the tide of World War II. Germany would have lost, but the Russians may not have gotten much of Eastern Europe, maybe the fringe of Poland or something along that. Well, and, you know, we're talking counterfactuals and speculation.
Well, one thing that I guess is for sure is that when the Germans were preparing for this battle, there was uncertainty and ambivalence about whether or not to go forward with it. And as you say in your book, Hitler kept postponing the attack.
Right.
And so somebody asked him, do you believe mein Führer, that anyone else knows where Kursk is? Why do you want to attack in the east, particularly this year?
Right.
And so, you know, this is a challenge to, I'm not sure how Hitler dealt with people who challenged his thinking about it, but he responded, you are quite right. The thought of this attack upsets my stomach. And so
he still ordered it.
Yeah.
And then when it actually looked like they might win, he called it off.
Is that right?
So he didn't have the final audacity, as they would say.
And if he had, would it have made a difference?
There was still an untouched German armored corps that could have broken through. I don't know. The Russians still had a lot of power left. The 5th Guards Tank Army, their reserve was pretty much wiped out. But he didn't. Would he have won the war? No. The best he could have hoped for was a stalemate. May have just won a nuclear sweepstakes. We would have dropped it on Berlin instead of Hiroshima or something like that. The war was already, the war was already decided. It was decided on December 7th, 1941. And, you know, I'm sure a very good argument can be made that Pearl Harbor was the most decisive battle of World War II. And we just decided we're not going to write about a bunch of planes coming in and sinking U.S. ships. It's a profound moment, but it wasn't a good story. And most people don't see it as the most decisive battle of the war because we lost.
But, yeah. Well, I love the theory, and this is outside the realm of your book. But did anybody on the Axis side, on the our opponent's side at Pearl Harbor, understand this? Did Hitler, for instance, understand that if the Americans
Hitler
ended the war?
Some of the Japanese probably understood it. You know, one of their admirals said, I can guarantee you 6 months of unprecedented victory and then nothing but ruin and disaster. Another admiral said, I feel we have awoken a monster we cannot possibly hope to defeat. The Japanese just hoped to get as much of their, a barrier chain built that would hold us, stalemate us against their, you know, the outer islands long enough that they can negotiate some sort of peace with the U.S. Hitler didn't think we could mobilize for many years. I mean, on December 11th, 4 days after Pearl Harbor, Germany declared war on the United States. I mean, here he is fighting England, fighting Russia. You know, he still hasn't gotten to Moscow. It's December of 41. And he rushes back after Pearl Harbor to Reichstag and declares war on the most industrial powerful nation in the world. Made everything easier for Roosevelt, who was like, you know, the Japanese attacked us. How do we fight the Germans since they didn't declare war? I read something a long time ago. The best move Hitler could have made at Pearl Harbor was to declare war on Japan in support of the United States. how would that have changed?
I think that's your next book, maybe. Maybe that should be your next book. What are you working on, Jim Lacy? Thanks for visiting with us.
We're working on two books. One I'm working on with my co-author, The Gods of War. It won't be out for a long time.
What's that about?
When great generals fight each other. The great captains in history. There's a lot of great captains, but rarely do we find a great captain, two great captains in the same era, Grant Lee, Napoleon, Wellington, Scipio, and Hannibal. So we're looking for those times in history when there's been two great generals who have come in to actually fight each other. Instead of having one great general beaten up on a whole bunch of mediocre generals, we're looking for the great ones. And the second book, which I'm researching now, and actually I've written the first chapter, is FDR's Inner Circle. You Team of Rivals, you're familiar with that?
Yeah. This is the Team of Rivals approach to Roosevelt's...
It struck me. Team of Rivals is just a great book, and then I looked and said, no one ever did that for World War II, or World War I for that matter. So I'm doing... FDR's Inner Circle, which the research is fascinating. I hope the book is just as fascinating.
Well, Jim Lacy, I hope that you'll take time to visit with us when it's finally ready. In the meantime, thanks for this book and for visiting with us here down in Chapel Hill.
Okay.
Our guest has been Jim Lacy. Thanks for listening. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.